Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Yes, good. Okay, great. All right, so the talk this morning spent a lot of time talking about what's on the horizon for cystic fibrosis, and it's pretty amazing, the advances in medicine. And we expect that with all the advances, people, as we know, are continuing to live longer, but that lung transplant does become an option for some people if the disease progresses. So today, in my part of the talk, I want to tell you about the preoperative evaluation. What happens when we start to think about transplant? When should we think about transplant? Some of the outcomes that you can expect after transplant, and then we'll review some of the specific considerations we think about in transplant for patients with cystic fibrosis. In general, around the world, we're doing over 4,000 transplants each year. The majority of those, as you can see by the red bars, are double lung transplants. And in cystic fibrosis, we routinely do double lung transplants to reduce the risk of infection. CF accounts for about 60% of transplants each year in the United States, 16%. And so we are doing about 2,000 lung transplants each year, and over about 200 of those are for cystic fibrosis. So you can see that the number of transplants done each year for CF has been fairly stable, about 200 each year. And that part of that is because patients are living longer, therapy is getting better. But there was an interesting study done by the CF Foundation Patient Registry. They looked at patients with severe obstruction, so severe lung disease, and FEV1 of less than 30% for 2 years. By guidelines, those are patients that we should be thinking about lung transplant in. And they found that 35% of those patients were never referred to a lung transplant center. And what were some of the reasons why, or some of the characteristics of the group of people who were not referred? One was Medicaid insurance. One was older age. So for every 5 years older a patient was, there was an increased risk that they were not referred. A lack of high school graduate education, and B, Sapatia culture positivity. And as we'll talk about in this discussion, these are not contraindications to transplant. So I think there are certainly other factors that may have contributed. Patients may not have been interested. They may have been stable for a long time. But there's certainly an opportunity here for us to offer transplant to a greater population of people. And so what I'm hoping to do today is kind of talk about when we should be thinking about transplant so that we can get as many people in as we need to. So when we think about timing of referral, the truth is the earlier, the better. Transplant is a big thing, it's a big surgery, and there's a lot of factors that go into thinking about transplant in patients. So the more time we have to prepare patients, both medically, but also psychosocially and financially, the better. What we're trying to get referred to us is patients who have a high risk of death due to lung disease within 2 years if they don't get a lung transplant, so an over 50% risk of death, with patients who will have a high likelihood of doing well after transplant. So that means that you're in good, otherwise physical condition. So we do have guidelines for listing patients for transplant for cystic fibrosis. Patients who have severe disease with an FEV1 of less than 30% predicted. If you're having recurrent exacerbations, in particular exacerbations that might require a stay in the intensive care unit. If you're having other organ damage, so the development of pulmonary hypertension or strain on the heart as a result of your lung disease, if you need oxygen, if your carbon dioxide is high, if you're having pneumothoraces or severe hemoptysis, those are all reasons that we should be thinking about lung transplant as an option. There are some situations which we say lung transplant is probably not the best idea in this specific situation. Some of these are listed here. One would be cancer, so cancer or cancer within 5 years of transplant. If you have another severe organ dysfunction, for example, if you had severe liver disease but did not qualify for a lung or liver transplant combined, or severe kidney disease, or another organ dysfunction that we couldn't treat, that would be a reason we would not offer transplant. Obesity with a body mass index of over 35, active tobacco use, and lack of social support or major social derangement would be also absolute contraindications. When a patient comes to our clinic, What we're trying to do is think about all the things that need to happen for transplant and see how we can optimize the situation so that we have the greatest chance of success for transplant. So we spend some time thinking about the medical perspective. So how severe is your lung function? How well does your heart work? Do you have other comorbidities that we can think about, like heartburn, reflux, renal dysfunction? Are you in good shape? Is the rest of your body in good condition? Is your nutritional status great? Are you exercising? Like the video showed, you know, being active is a great form of airway clearance, and it's also a great way to make sure your transplant outcome is as good as possible. And then also, are you psychosocially ready? Transplant, as I said before, is a big step, and we need to make sure patients are mentally prepared and committed, as is their family or social support. So there are some specific things we think about in a patient with cystic fibrosis who's going on to organ transplant. First is sinus disease. As you know, we're replacing the lung, but we're not replacing the entire airway. Sinuses can be a reservoir for bacterial pathogen. There's some data that shows that sinus surgery may decrease infections after transplant and potentially reduce the risk of chronic rejection. We don't routinely recommend sinus surgery, but we do really emphasize good sinus hygiene, nasal rinses, and we work closely with ear, nose, and throat. But sinusitis is not a contraindication for transplant. Many patients with cystic fibrosis have osteoporosis, also not a contraindication to transplant, only if there are severe compression fractures that interfere with your ability to ambulate. Otherwise, we treat that as we would any other condition. As our previous speaker mentioned, many patients have prior chest surgery for pneumothoraces or other complications. You can see a pneumothorax in about 20% of CF patients. There's no difference in mortality in patients with prior thoracic procedures. That's not a contraindication to transplant. It may cause a prolonged hospital stay, but we've seen long-term outcomes be just as good. Being on a mechanical ventilation can be slightly increased risk at the time of surgery, but overall outcomes are also just as good and also is not a contraindication. And finally, malnutrition. We know that as lung disease progresses, it's harder and harder to maintain weight. Ideally, we would like a body mass index over 18, and oftentimes we will use supplemental tube feeds to make that happen. But we don't. That's not an absolute cutoff, and we work with patients on an individual basis to optimize their nutritional status. There are other factors that we think about, but that have been shown to have no impact on outcomes. So if you have multi-drug resistant Pseudomonas, Aspergillus, early or mild cirrhosis, and diabetes really have no impact on outcomes. I wanted to spend a few moments talking about infections, because that can be an added layer of complexity when we think about transplant in a cystic fibrosis recipient. There are a couple of infections that you guys may have heard about that can impact outcomes after transplant. And here in this slide, we see there is a slight reduced survival in patients who have Burkholderia sepatia, where we don't see much of a difference in patients who have abscesses. And I'm going to spend a few moments talking about that. The first infection I want to talk about is Burkholderia sinosepatia. So Burkholderia sepatia is a family of bacterial organisms, and there are various subtypes of Burkholderia sepatia. Of patients who have Burkholderia sepatia, about 30% have sinosepatia. And we know that specific bacterial organism can be quite dangerous and can cause a necrotizing pneumonia, sepsis, or death in patients both before and after transplant. And in patients with Burkholderia sinosepatia who've been transplanted, we have had poor outcomes. So this is typically a contraindication to transplant. However, there are other varieties of Burkholderia sepatia, such as multivorans and gladioli, that we do transplant. So if somebody says, oh, I have Burkholderia sepatia, it's very important to dig into the culture results and really give them an opportunity to think about transplant, because there are subtypes that we do transplant successfully. Mycobacterium abscessus is an atypical mycobacteria. It can cause respiratory infections prior to transplant. Post-transplant, we've seen it cause skin and soft tissue infections. It is difficult to treat, often requires multiple IV antibiotics. And often patients who get transplanted with abscessus are on therapy for at least 6 to 12 months after transplant. However, we have transplanted 7 patients at our center with Mycobacterium abscessus. 5 of those 7 patients had cystic fibrosis, and only one patient died in the first year for a complication that was unrelated to the abscesses. So although this has historically been considered a contraindication to transplant, I think more and more centers are understanding that although it adds a little bit of complexity, it's certainly something that we can work around. And at UCSF, for example, we do transplant patients with abscesses. And the third infectious complication I wanted to highlight is Scedosporium, which is a type of fungal infection. So we know in general for patients who have invasive fungal disease that is found on the explanted lung, they're more likely to have fungal infections post-transplant. If you're just colonized, if it's just in a sputum culture, but there's no evidence on a CT scan that you have fungal infection, that does not seem to impact outcomes. There's a specific type of Scedosporium, Scedosporium prolificans, that is extremely difficult to treat. It requires multiple antifungals in combination. There's high rates of resistance, and this specific fungus is considered a relative contraindication to transplant. However, although there are several infections that make complexity to transplant, in general, most patients with cystic fibrosis can go on to successful transplant. And it's just another plug for an early referral so that as the transplant pulmonologist, we can really think through how to optimize the care of all these infections. When we think about, okay, you've gone through the evaluation, we've optimized in the best way possible, and we've made the decision that now is the time to go on the list. How do we allocate donor organs? So we get an offer, how do we decide who on our waiting list gets the transplant? And prior to 2005, we used to say, okay, you're gonna go on the list and we'll just move right up the list and you'll get ones in order. And what we realized is that everybody's disease, lung disease, acts differently. And so it's probably a better idea for us to take into account disease severity when we're prioritizing a transplant. And so now we have a lung allocation score. And that score uses characteristics of each patient to prioritize based on how quickly they need a transplant, as well as how successful the transplant is likely to be. So it factors in medical tests and the diagnosis. And in general, the score tends to favor patients with interstitial lung diseases that are rapidly progressive. And I just wanted to show you a sample of the lung allocation score calculator. So you can go online and plug in characteristics of a patient and get a lung allocation score. It's a dynamic score. It changes from day to day. It takes into account height, weight, whether you have diabetes, if you need oxygen, what your lung function is, and it comes up with a score. And based on that score, we're able to prioritize donor lungs to patients who need them the most. The score ranges from 30 to 100, and typical outpatients have a score of around 30 to 50. The typical time to wait on a transplant list is around 6 months, but that's very variable depending on patient characteristics. What we found in cystic fibrosis patients in the era of the lung allocation score is there is a clear survival benefit of transplant in patients with cystic fibrosis now that we're using the lung allocation score, and this refers to adult data. So now I've talked about kind of getting to transplant. What do you expect after you have transplant? What is the benefit of a lung transplant? And we know that there's a clear survival benefit. The median survival, or the average survival after a transplant in general for two lungs is 7.4 years. For those patients who survive the first year, who don't have a lot of operative complication, that number raises up to almost 10 years. And I wanted to also present our UCSF data, which looks at it in a slightly different way. 96% of our patients survive a year, and 83% survive 3 years. So in general, the survival is quite good. And when we look at diagnosis-specific survival, how does survival in cystic fibrosis patients compare to other pre-transplant diagnoses? In fact, cystic fibrosis patients have some of the best survival outcomes. On average, 9.2 year survival, which means that half of patients are actually living longer than 9 years. So this is a really encouraging data. And we don't want to just focus on duration of life. We also want to think about quality of life, right? So I can give you a transplant and you can live, but are you going to be able to do the things that you want to do? And two studies have looked at quality of life recently across lung transplant and found clear benefit in nearly all recipients in terms of quality of life. So patients feel better, they're able to do more, they have less depression, less anxiety, and in fact, when we look at it within diagnoses, patients with cystic fibrosis often have the greatest benefit. There are other considerations that we want to think about post-transplant in the management of a patient with cystic fibrosis. As infections can be a common complication leading up to transplant, we are also often dealing with infections post-transplant. So we know that cystic fibrosis patients after transplant often have a lot of infections, but they're absolutely manageable and do not have a long-term difference in survival. Patients with pan-resistant bacteria have slightly reduced survival, but again, it does not impact the ability to get transplant. We have not found any differences in survival with MRSA. We do know across all transplant recipients, Pseudomonas colonization is associated with chronic rejection. And so we are very aggressive in terms of trying to eradicate Pseudomonas. Many patients remain on inhaled antibiotics after transplant. There are a few other medical considerations I wanted to review before I turn it over to Dr. Kukreja. Other things that we think about post-transplant are malignancy. Because we're suppressing the immune system to allow the lungs to not reject and for your body to accept the new lungs, there is an increased risk of cancer. Cystic fibrosis patients in general are at increased risk for, in particular, gastrointestinal cancers. And so we do very aggressive screening for all cancers post-transplant. In particular, fertility can be very challenging after transplant, and so that's a benefit of an early referral to think through that if that's a priority, because the medications after transplant can interfere with the ability to have a baby. And then there are gastrointestinal complications that can occur, including reflux, distal intestinal outlet obstruction, Clostridium difficile infection. Although there are some complexities pre-transplant, there are also complications that we think about post-transplant, but all of them are things that we can proactively deal with and screen for. Unfortunately, some of our patients do develop chronic rejection and ultimately the lungs fail. And in particular, in cystic fibrosis, many of our patients are younger. And so 10 years to somebody who's 25, an average survival of 20 years, doesn't always sound as appealing. But retransplantation is an option. If your first transplant develops chronic rejection and you have graft failure, we do offer retransplant in selected patients. And that accounts for about 4% of procedures per year. Of the patients who had a retransplant, 40% of those had cystic fibrosis as their primary reason to get a first transplant. And a retransplant outcome survival is actually quite good, with an average survival of about 6.5 years. So I'm going to stop there and tell you that I hope that I've told you that lung transplant is a good option for patients who develop respiratory failure with cystic fibrosis. The outcomes continue to improve, and if patients are referred early, we have the ability to optimize several medical factors, including infections and nutrition, to plan for the most successful transplant possible. And I just wanted to show this picture of one of our patients who was transplanted with cystic fibrosis. This is her in the hospital and then enjoying her life, hiking, biking. And when I called her to say, hey, can I use your picture in this talk? She said, oh, I'm at Great Adventure. I'm having a great time. And so although we obviously hope that many patients will not need transplant in the future with medical innovations, when you do need transplant, it can be a transformative, amazing thing. And so just keep it in mind for those patients that you meet or see who are having declining lung function. And we're happy to answer more questions at the end, but I'm going to turn it over now to Dr. Kukreja. Yeah.
All right, thanks, Rupal. That was excellent. All right, so I have no financial disclosures. I am going to be presenting a study here, device-related industry-sponsored trial that I'm the UCSF site principal investigator of. And I'm going to show a bunch of pictures and a couple of videos. I did get the permission of the patients to use them for educational purposes. And I am also going to send a disclaimer that viewer discretion is advised if it's too graphic. So I think we heard from Dr. Jain, there's a reason we're talking about lung transplant, because there is no cure for CF yet, right? So there's stem cell therapy, gene therapies are in the pipeline, but not quite there yet. He went over these drugs, so there's been some progress on the medical front, but the improvement in lung function is modest. So that brings us to lung transplantation. And I think lung transplantation is an excellent option when there's no hope for these patients. Not only does it improve the survival, but as Rupal mentioned, quality of life is significantly improved as well. She showed you this graph already, so for the sake of time, I think we're running behind, I'm gonna skip it, but the take-home point is, of all the different types of conditions we perform the lung transplant for, cystic fibrosis patients do the best. So, however, as much as I'm advocating lung transplant, we do have a problem. 20% of our patients who are waiting on the list do not get an organ in time, and that's because of organ shortage. This graph is basically what it's showing is that the blue bars are showing a number of transplants that are being performed each year on the x-axis, and you can see that number of transplants getting performed are increasing every year, but at the same time, looking at the red line, the number of patients being added to the wait list is also increasing. So the gap here between those listed and those getting transplanted still persists due to organ shortage. This slide, basically, I was updating my slides last night, and this is, as you can see, from 10 o'clock last night, there are still 1,500 patients in the U.S. who are waiting for a lung transplant. So as a surgeon, what can I do, what can I offer to my cystic fibrosis patients to increase their survivals? So I essentially have two strategies. One is to keep my patients alive. My pulmonary colleagues are usually doing a fantastic job, but once in a while, maybe once or twice a year, the medical therapy fails and we need to figure out how to keep them alive until a suitable organ becomes available. But equally important is how do we get the organs to them and how fast can we get it to them when they do get to that stage? So keeping the patients alive, okay? So as I mentioned, every once in a while, happens about two or three times a year, cystic fibrosis patient has been managed very well, has taken excellent care of themselves, doing pulmonary toilet, but for whatever reason, the infection, the medical therapy is not working, or the pulmonary toilet procedures they are performing at home have also been ineffective. So what can we do under those circumstances? We can provide them some sort of artificial means to keep them alive until the organ becomes available. So one way to do that is to intubate them and put them on the mechanical ventilator. Sorry. So they have a tube that goes into the mouth and air is being pumped with the ventilator into the lungs. As you can imagine, this is not very comfortable for the patient, which means in order to afford some comfort, we will have the patient be sedated and paralyzed. And as you can imagine, again, if somebody's bedridden, not doing anything, they're gonna be fairly debilitated and deconditioned. And as Rupal mentioned, patients who do go into transplant like that, they tend to, generally speaking, have poorer outcomes coming out of transplant. So what can we do? How can we keep them awake, strong, going into transplant? So this is where this technology comes in. I think most people have heard about it. It's called ECMO. It stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation support, or surgeons call it extremely costly midnight operation. Because that's generally speaking when it happens. So basically the concept in this technology is that we take the blood out of the body because the lungs are not doing what they're supposed to do. So we take the blood outside the body, pump it through an oxygenator, which is supposedly the artificial lung, and it's pumped back into the body, oxygenated. So this device can not only support the lungs, because it's also pumping the blood back, it can also support the heart. And in some of our cystic fibrosis patients, they do have pulmonary hypertension, and when pulmonary hypertension happens, and if it's a severe form, it can affect the heart function. So sometimes not only do they need a lung support, they also need heart support. But more importantly, our goal always is to have an awake, walking, talking, potentially, and exercising patient, so they go into transplant strong so they can have good outcomes. So at UCSF, our program was established in 1991. Since then, we have performed now over 700 lung transplants. Our ECMO program was the first on the West Coast. It was established in 2004. The other programs in our state especially have just come on board in the last 3-4 years. So for almost 10 years, we were the only center on the West Coast who was performing ECMO bridge to lung transplant for really critically ill end-stage lung disease patients. This slide is not entirely updated because as of this year, we have now over 50 such critically ill lung transplant patients who've been bridged successfully. This bottom here is mumbo jumbo for some people, but basically what it means is that there are different types of cannulation strategies that we perform, and it is customized to each patient's disease condition. I'm going to show some videos. So the video on the left, can we play it? So this is a 51-year-old cystic fibrosis patient who was transferred emergently from an outside hospital. As I said, she's 51 years old, so she's never been referred to so much for the circle. But so she was emergently referred because she developed respiratory failure, and despite being on mechanical ventilation, she could not be oxygenated or ventilated. She did have severe pulmonary hypertension as well. So she came to us paralyzed, sedated. A week after we finished emergent evaluation on her, we initiated ECMO support. This is a special type of ECMO support that supported both her heart and lungs. And 2 weeks following that, as you can see, she's up, walking, exercising. We performed a lung transplant. The young woman on the left-hand side, she was actually our patient who was already on the wait list. She was waiting patiently at home, and then one day her lung collapsed, developed a pneumothorax, despite chest tube placements and even surgical intervention, the lung just did not reinflate and it remained collapsed. So as a result of that, despite being on mechanical ventilation, she could not be oxygenated. She could not be ventilated. She could not get rid of carbon dioxide from her body. So we had to emergently put her on ECMO. And this one was only supporting the lung. And you can't see the ECMO device, but it is in her right neck. And that headband around the forehead is holding the cannula in place. And as you can see, she's also exercising on the treadmill. And she was transplanted within 13 days following the ECMO deployment. So this is a different type of cannulation strategy. This patient actually needed a heart-lung transplant because of severe pulmonary hypertension had affected the heart to the degree that we did not think that she would do well with just lung transplant. She was also referred to us, can we play the video please? She was also referred to us for emergently for evaluation. She was also paralyzed, sedated in her case. I chose central cannulation because her heart really needed full support. And following day, she was off the ventilator. She's up walking around just one day following having her chest opened up. So UCSF was also the first in the country to have performed a walking veno-venous ECMO. which is the lung support ECMO only. The gentleman on the left here has become quite popular. You see his picture on the internet quite frequently as being the first Avalon ECMO person who was successfully transplanted. The gentleman on the right is another cystic fibrosis patient, as Rupal mentioned. Everybody knows cystic fibrosis patients are young when they get transplanted. So this gentleman here had already had one transplant 7 years prior, and then he developed chronic rejection. And when he developed chronic rejection, it was fairly severe, to the point that he needed to be supported on the ECMO device also, and he was also successfully transplanted. So we published our ECMO bridge to transplant experience in 2012, and I'm gonna take a couple of minutes to just go over this graph. So the blue line at the top is patients who have high LS scores, means they have higher degree of severity of illness in our patient population at UCSF. And when we compared it to the national average of a similar cohort of patients. Now, these patients are not on ECMO, and neither are these patients. So this is UCSF group, and this is all the other centers in the country for same exact LAS category of LAS scores. When you look at our outcome versus other centers in the country, you can see that despite the severity of illness, our patients at UCSF do very well. Now let's focus on the ECMO group. Sorry. The bottom line was ECMO, I apologize. The top line is without ECMO at UCSF, and the red line is rest of the country without ECMO. And now let's compare the two ECMO group, which is this one and this one. So the top line is our center at UCSF of patients that were on ECMO, bridge to transplant. And as you can see, even at 1 year in these most critical of critical patients, they have a one-year survival of close to 97%. But when you compare the same type of patients in the rest of the country, their survival is quite poor. So this was one of the main reasons why people were very reluctant to bridge patient on from ECMO to transplant, because what they saw was this poor survival. But once our data got published, what we saw was this trend. We saw that we published our data in 2012, and you can see after 2012, there was a significant increase in the number of patients being bridged to transplanted from ECMO. Not only that, more and more centers started to adopt this technology, which I think is great that more patients are able to be saved with this new technology. So we talked about how can we keep the patients alive, and I mentioned that not only is that important, the other important, equally important part of this equation is how can we get the organs and get the organs fast for them. So I showed you that 20% of patients do not make it or get an organ in time. They die on the waiting list. So what are the different strategies we could employ to make an organ become available to them? So before I launch into what the different innovations have occurred to address this problem as a thoracic transplant community, I just want to briefly review with you what is the process, what is the current standard for organ allocation? How many here know how organs get transported? How do we do organ recovery? Does anybody know? You know. So what the current standard is that we will go to the donor hospital if it happens to be ours, so we stay there. So basically we will recover the organs. We've already decided before we went there that these organs are good. When we go there, we look at the organs and say, yes, the phone call was right, we have good organs, we will recover them, and we will bring them, we will cool them way down, because cold temperature reduces the metabolic rate, so we are trying to preserve the organ. So then we would transport the organs on an ice box, so to speak, ice chest. And that's how we do organ recovery, and we bring the organs back, and then we implant into the recipient. Now, for every 10 phone calls that I get, let's say I get 10 phone calls today with 10 different organ offers. Do you know how many I will accept to even bother to go see? Sonia knows. Yes, right on. So 8 organ offers I'm gonna turn down. And the reason is the following. It could be any number of those reasons. The donor could have been involved in a motor vehicle accident and it could have crushed the lungs, or the donor had been on the ventilator, and we know ventilator can cause all kinds of injuries to the lung, and one of them being pneumonia. And also, there could be too much fluid on the lungs. Now, what is the problem with that? Why can't we treat those things in the donor and, you know, make the organs better? It's not that simple. How can you go to the donor's family and ask them, well, can we treat your loved one for one more week and keep them alive to take these organs? Not only that, we also have the issue that one donor saves 8 lives. And how do they do that? Because they're also donating liver, kidneys, heart, pancreas, bowel, all kinds of stuff, right? So I may be trying to make my organs better for my recipient, but I may be jeopardizing all other organs. So the sad thing is that the 8 organs offers that I rejected, we believe that 40% of those are perfectly salvageable if we have the time to evaluate them, assess them, and possibly even treat them with antibiotics or with diuretic therapy, get some fluid off, right? So how do we do that? So this is where the breathing lung technology came into place. Dr. Stigstein, he's a professor in Sweden, a surgeon, thoracic surgeon like myself. He thought that, you know, this is a major problem. Patients are dying waiting to get organs. So what if I didn't get time to treat the organs while the organs were still in the donor? What if I replicated the donor's conditions, physiologic conditions, outside the body and have time to assess and treat? What would then happen? So what he did was took these organs. Let's see if it's the next slide. So what he did was he took those organs out of the donor that had been turned down by everybody. He hooked the organs up to a ventilator. So remember, the patient usually had a breathing tube put into the mouth. It goes into the windpipe. Here, the breathing tube goes straight into the windpipe because there's no patient, right? And then the other thing he did was not only he oxygenated these organs, he also provided nutrition to the organs with a solution that was circulating through the lungs, like the heart would do and the rest of the body would do. So he provided oxygenation and nutrition to the lungs. And then on top of that, he also added anti-inflammatory agents and antibiotics to treat the organs. So he monitored the organs for 4 to 6 hours, and actually the first one that he did was almost 17 hours he monitored. And at the end of the day, it was supposed to have been a research, and he decided that, well, the organ looks too good, and he did not want to waste it, even though it was a research protocol only. He went ahead and transplanted a patient. He got into big trouble with his institution, but the patient walked out of the hospital in 7 days. And that's what started this breathing lung technology. And since then, we have now, the things you can do. All the things you could do in a donor when the donor is kept artificially alive, you can do all of those things on this machine. You can do bronchoscopy, you can measure pressures, you can do all kinds of things. So his paper was published in the early 2000s, and after that, there's just been several different devices have come on the market. The main difference is the basic concept is the same regardless of what type of device is out on the market. There are some differences. Some devices you can travel with to the donor hospital and put the organs immediately on the device. Some you bring back. Some of them are a closed circuit, open circuit, blood versus no blood, depending on what your philosophy is. So these are some of the devices here. This is the one that Dr. Steen developed. Sorry, no, this is the one that Canadian group developed called the XPS device. And then we have this device, OCS device, which is the portable and pulsatile device. So it mimics the function of the heart. So when it pumps nutrition and blood through the organs, it actually does it in a pumping fashion as opposed to a continuous flow. And then this last one is the one that Dr. Steen had developed. The first original device. So at UCSF, so we are the only center in the Bay Area that have performed a lung transplant off this device. I went with the portable pulsatile device, the OCS device platform. I participated in these trials. The first two trials have already completed. The first trial has been published as of this year. This trial is looking at the outcomes right now, and the last EXPAND 2 trial just began this year. So I'm just going to briefly review the results of the INSPIRE trial. As I mentioned, it was a large international randomized control trial that compared cold storage lung to the breathing lung technology. And there were 21 centers involved in this trial, both in the US as well as outside of US. 320 patients were enrolled, and we were one of the sites, and we enrolled 21 patients. As I mentioned, we just published these results in Lancet this year. You can see the findings from this is that cold lungs, and this is in the early first 30 day following lung transplant. Cold lungs are this, the traditional way that we brought the organs back. The higher the bar, the worse the outcome, okay? And these are the breathing lungs. And you can see that by putting the organs on the device, the outcome actually got better. So it's the opposite, okay? So we're looking at incidence of primary graft dysfunction that for whatever reasons the lung were having difficulty following implantation working. So the cold stored lungs had a higher incidence of dysfunction compared to the breathing lung technology. So then we went on to do the EXPAND trial number one. Now, this is the trial that I'm most interested in. And if I were the patient, that's where I want to put my money. Because the standard of care lung versus breathing lung technology, until long-term results come out, I'm not sure there's a lot of utility in it. But the EXPAND trial, where we're actually taking the turn down organs and making them better and increasing the donor pool, I think that's where the impact of this device is going to be. So these are turn down organs, rejected organs that nobody has accepted. Then they place it with centers that are doing this trial, which was one of us on the West Coast. And we were part of 8 sites international again. There were 6 sites in the US and 2 outside of US, 1 in Germany and 1 in Belgium. There were 75 participants who were enrolled in this trial. At UCSF, I enrolled 9. And remember, these are organs that were turned down, right? Nobody wanted them. I put them on the device, and out of those 9 lungs, I ended up transplanting 5. Now, these are 5 lives saved, where there would have been none, right? So instead of what I mentioned earlier, that 80% of the organs are turned down, and we think that we can save, out of those 8 organs turned down, 3 or 4, we saved more than half, right? And the other 2, they could have been 7 organs transplanted. The reason the other 2 were not transplanted was because even though the donor organs looked great on the device, when I started the recipient operation, we discovered that our recipient had lung cancer. So we had to back out. So it wasn't because of the organs, it was because the recipient had cancer. And in the second patient, we turned down the organ, not because the organs weren't functioning well, they looked beautiful. But there was one number, remember I mentioned you can do all kinds of measurements on the device. There was one measurement, I couldn't figure out what to make of it because it gives you so much information and we don't yet know what all that means. And we didn't feel comfortable. So we said, okay, we're not gonna take a chance. So the benefit is that you know till the very last minute before the organs go into your body, how they're functioning. Whereas in the cold storage, you know how they functioned in the donor, then they sat on ice for 6 hours, and then you put them in the recipient and you hope they're gonna still work, right? So I think there are a lot of safety built into this. So this trial completed, and we were part of that trial. And as I mentioned, this is the second trial that has restarted this year in March, and we came on board in April. And we have, again, done the first transplant on the West Coast of this device in this trial. This was a very interesting case. A month and a half ago, one of our patients got very sick at home to the point that his oxygenation could not be maintained at home, so he needed to be admitted to the hospital. He actually not only got admitted to the hospital, he was in the intensive care unit on the verge of death. So we approached him with the concept that, you know, he has such limited time if we didn't find him suitable organs. So I approached him to enroll in this trial. He agreed. And we found a set of organs that every single transplant center all the way to Utah turned it down. And we said, okay, we will take it. And we put it on the device. I monitored it for 6 hours. And the organs were gorgeous. And we transplanted him, and he walked out of the hospital 10 days later. So this is really exciting. So I'm not gonna spend a lot of time, but when I meet with patients during their preoperative evaluation, I usually bring up this concept of DCD lung donors. I think DCD basically stands for donation after circulatory death or cardiac death. Before I tell you what that means, I want to first tell you where majority of the organs come from. So majority of the organs come from brain dead donors, okay? So 95% of the organs in the United States come from donors who have been declared brain dead. Which means that if they have lost all reflexes that maintain life, so which means also that we're artificially keeping them alive until we find and have an agreement on organ procurement. So as I said, 95% of our donors in the U.S. come from that. DCD donor, however, is a donor that's not brain dead, but they have a neurological injury that is irrecoverable. As a result of this irrecoverable injury, they are ventilator dependent. Either they may have advanced directives stating that if they needed long-term life support, they don't want to stay alive, or the family member would have said, okay, this is not how my loved one would have liked to have lived, so they would like to have the organs donated, but they're not brain dead. So that's DCD donation. There are a lot of ethical concerns in the U.S. around it, but the bottom line is, in the U.S., this type of donation is increasing in number. As you can see from this registry, the numbers are continuing to increase. In Australia and in Europe, 30 to 40% of lung donation comes from such donors. And the outcomes between brain dead donors and DCD donors, you can see the curves are exactly overlapping, means they're exactly or very similar. There's no difference. So I mentioned that already. So right now, the other last one, this is where how I'm gonna end. Another category of donor is the living related donor transplant. It was pioneered in the US, but is no longer performed in the US, whereas this is the main form of lung donation in Japan. Basically, and it mainly happens in cystic fibrosis patients and mainly in pediatric recipients. So what happens is if this is the child, perhaps with cystic fibrosis. This is mom, this is dad. They donate, mom donates one part of her right lung and dad donated, you know, left part of, left lobe of the left lung, and they give it to their child. And outcomes for with this type of donation have been excellent, but obviously it requires a lot of coordination and it has lost favor in the US. I am thinking about re-exploring it because the gentleman who did most of these transplants in Japan is now at UCSF and I want to take advantage of it. I think Rupal already showed you the outcomes for our center. So I'm very thankful to have found this job that's so rewarding, and for all the families and patients who have given me the opportunity to be part of their lives. So I'm happy to take any questions. And Rupal, you want to come up too?